OK, bonjour tout le monde. Bienvenue à cette deuxième journée de notre colloque, le colloque du lancement du Centre de recherche interdisciplinaire en études montréalaises. Our conference is entitled La créativité urbaine en question, le cadre de Montréal, ville créative. My name is Will Strahm, director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada and one of the interim directors of the center as we move forward. So it's my great pleasure to welcome you to this first session. We have three very interesting papers, and we're going to go in the order on the program. Each presenter has about 35 minutes, including questions and discussion. So it's really up to you whether you want to take up most of that time with your paper or leave some for discussion. Is that a no, Anouk? Okay. On va commencer par Sébastien Brault, who is Associate Professor of Geography at McGill University. He received his PhD in Economic Geography from UCLA. His research focuses on labor market dynamics, international trade, and regional government. He has published in a number of international journals and is currently working on a book examining the spatial dimensions of inequality in Canada. And his paper is called, appropriately enough, On the Relationship Between Creativity and Inequality, New Evidence from Montreal and Other Canadian Cities.
Thanks, Will, and good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure for me to be here to talk to you about some of my work on the relationship between innovation and inequality. So there is a subtle change there, right? I'll come back to that later on. Over the last 15 years or so, much has been said about the importance of creativity and innovation for cities, right, for urban growth. Now, this study is more about the potential dark side to innovation, right? So how is the wealth created from innovative activities actually distributed across society as a whole? So thinking about the wages individuals receive, right? What I do want to point out to before I actually get going here is that this study does not focus solely on Montreal. It's a comparative study, so we're actually going to be looking at what's happening across Canadian cities. Okay? Just to give you a brief outline of what I'm going to be talking about, right? I'll start with the motivation behind the research project. I'll identify the research questions that I'm actually going to be tackling. And then go through the literature very briefly, talk a little bit about data and methods, model specifications used in the analysis, and then we'll move on to showing you some descriptive results, analytical results, right, trying to explain the patterns that we're seeing. And then in terms of the conclusion, I'll say a little bit about the policy implication of the findings and also new future research directions. Okay, so what's the starting point? It's actually captured fairly well here with this first graph on the top left-hand corner here, which shows the evolution of income inequality across the nation over a 30-year period, right? And if you look at this graph, you can actually see that starting in the early 1990s, mid-1990s, what we see is a steady increase in the level of income inequality. Right? This actually corresponds with the IT boom of the 1990s, right, when the darlings of industry were firms like Nortel, RIM, etc. Now, this increase in inequality is not a Canadian-only phenomenon, right? We're actually seeing, by the mid-2000s, a lot of OECD countries with actually very high levels of income inequality. This is what we see on the bottom chart here, right? What stands out in the Canadian case is that if we look at data from the mid-1990s to the mid-2000s, Canada experienced the second largest increase in income inequality of all OECD countries, right? So that's quite significant. And after a relative period of silence on the subject, right, we are now seeing some debate, right? You can see the headlines here taken from the Globe and Mail over the last year or two, right? It's now on the radar. We're talking about this increase in income inequality or earnings inequality. What does it mean, right? And across the public at large, you'll remember in the fall of 2011, right, the protests associated with the Occupy movement. And you'll recognize the encampment here, which was in the Victoria Square, right, the heart of the financial district here in Montreal. So with this context in mind, I'm essentially going after two sets of research questions here, right? The first, how are earnings distributed across metropolitan areas in Canada, and how have these patterns changed over that period? So we'll be looking at data from 1996 to 2006. And then how can we explain those differences, those changing patterns of income inequality? And the particular emphasis here is on the link between innovation and inequality, right? Is innovation one of the potentially key determinants, right, explanatory factors of that rising pattern of inequality? So the first part is about identifying the patterns, and then we're trying to explain those patterns, right? Now, the literature on income inequality is huge. It's vast, it's complex, right? By and far, most of the work has been done by economists, right, who tend to focus or limit their analytical lens on national level patterns, what's happening at the national level, right? So there are very few studies actually looking at subnational patterns and trying to identify the causes of those patterns. At the provincial level, Ross Finney has done some interesting work, David Gray and others at the University of Ottawa. Some of my past work has also looked at interprovincial differences in income inequality. Even fewer work at the regional level. And at the city level, right, most of the work has been done by geographers in the 1990s, right? So we can think of Larry Bourne, for instance, at the University of Toronto, Mitchell and Soraka. More recently, I have been also doing some work, right? But essentially, what's missing is a comprehensive analysis of patterns of income or earnings inequality across cities and regions, right? Explicitly focusing on that link between innovation and inequality. So how do we think about that link, right? How can innovation potentially lead to higher levels of income or earnings inequality? Well, there are essentially three mechanisms that are thought to lie behind or explain that potential link, right? The first one is the skills bias technological change argument, right? This is the argument that the introduction of new technologies in the workplace is benefiting those who have the skills to work with those technologies, right? So in other words, the less skilled workers are going to be left behind. We also have the local productivity effect, which essentially stems from the reorganization of production activities, moving away from the more rigid, tailoristic type production activities to the more flexible, multitask production schemes, right? So in other words, cities that are more innovative in terms of those flexible production activities will pay workers higher wages, right? And then finally, the third argument is the sorting or co-location effect, right? This is the argument that innovative cities attract highly skilled individuals, right? Talented individuals. But at the same time, it's also creating job opportunities for the less skilled individuals, essentially in the personal services, right? They are there to, do the chores of the highly skilled, talented individuals. Thus, you see this growing polarization between those two types of workers, right? This is the dark side of the Richard Florida creative class thesis, okay? Now, the problem from an empirical perspective is, how do we actually measure innovation, right? So I'm going to be using patent data, and I'll come back to tell you a little bit more about how we actually developed that data set, but it's an innovative data set. Yeah, choose the words right here, right? It's a unique, innovative, novel data set that allows us to explore this link a little further. Now, of course, innovation is not the only potential explanatory factor we have to be looking at, right? City size is, of course, also important. Now, there is a recent literature. Corpi has done some interesting work in Sweden, Bamsnow and Pavan in the U.S., basically looking at the city size distribution and where inequality is actually happening. And what we see is within the urban hierarchy, larger cities typically have much higher levels of earnings inequality. In terms of economic variables to be thinking about, industry composition is employment rights. So you can think about the deindustrialization hypothesis, the loss of jobs in the manufacturing sector. How is that affecting overall levels of inequality? public sector employment, right? Both of these tend to have a negative relationship, so they're seen as equalizers, in other words. And we can also add the unemployment rate there as a general proxy for overall economic conditions in a given city. Sociodemographic controls, right? What is the impact of the entrance of women on the labor force, right? Their higher female labor participation rates. We actually find in Canada a negative relationship, right? That really depends on the skill sets of the women as they enter the marketplace and at what point in the income distribution they actually enter. We have to control for the demographic structure of cities, the education profile, so higher levels of educational inequality also typically are leading to higher levels of earnings inequality, and then visible minorities and immigration, both of which are again positively associated to levels of inequality. And finally, there are also different institutional factors we need to consider, right? What is the impact of declining unionization rates, right? And what about the minimum wage argument also, okay? So these are some of the other covariates that factor into the model here. Now, to explore how these factors actually interact with levels of inequality, I work with two main data sets. The first is long-form census of the population here, right, which is the used to be the required 20% sample. We have this for 96, 2001, and 2006. Lots of benefits of working with this data, right? It's a very large data set. So we're talking about 6 million plus individual observations on the workers themselves, right? The questions from one census to the next are usually very stable and reliable over time. That is until Mr. Harper decided to switch to the National Household Survey back in 2011. The income data is very good in these data sets, right? They're not top-coded. This means we actually are not biasing downwards our measures of inequality. And of course, we have all kinds of information on the individual worker characteristics, their age, their education level, right? The year they immigrated into the country, the industry in which they work. We also have information on place of residence and place of work. Now, this is very important, right, in order to establish a geographical correspondence from one city boundary or how it's defined in terms of boundaries from one census to the next, right? These things change over time, so if we want to have a solid comparative basis, we've got to make sure that the boundaries are consistent. So what we do essentially is taking these individual worker observations, right, at a very small geographical level or detailed geographical level, we can then aggregate up to 2006 consistent boundaries in terms of the cities. And when we do so, we end up with a data set of 85 cities for the country as a whole. Now, the measures of inequality, right, I'm actually focusing on the active labor force. In other words, individuals aged between 25 and 65 who report a minimum annual earnings level of $1,000, right? And I'm going to be using two different measures of inequality, the Gini coefficient, which is widely used, well known, and also the Tile index, right? The rationale here is that using two different measures of inequality provides more robustness, right? They're sensitive to transfers in different parts of the distribution. The tile income usually picks, or the tile index picks up on movements at the top end of the distribution, whereas the Gini is more sensitive to what's happening in the middle of the distribution. The second data set I'm going to be using was actually developed by a colleague of mine, Dieter Kogler, at the University College Dublin, which is the Canadian Patent Database. Right? So what we're doing here is using information on the patents that are registered by Canadian inventors but filed with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Now, this may seem a little odd initially, right? Why not use the Canadian Intellectual Property Office's data for patents? Well, the reason is actually quite simple. Canadian inventors file with the USPTO four patents for every patent filed with the Canadian equivalent, right? Why is that? Well, it's faster to get it approved, granted in the US, and it also gives them security over a larger market, okay? So what we have then is for each inventor, we have the residential address, which we can geocode and then again allocate to the 2006 city level boundaries, right? This is actually quite interesting and very detailed. So in the end, the measure of innovation is the number of patents registered per million residents for each city. Okay, so let's look at some numbers here to get a sense of what's going on. Starting with overall trends in earnings inequality. There are really three things to take away from this table. First, at the national level, right, what we see is that over a relatively short period of time, 10 years, right, inequality has increased significantly, 7% as measured by the Gini coefficient. It's actually much more pronounced when we look at the tile index. It's something like 30.1%. There's also, secondly, a geographical divide between urban and non-urban regions, right? Inequality is really an urban phenomenon. Look at the growth rate for urban regions compared to rural parts of the country, right? 9% versus 1.9. And thirdly, if you look at the coefficient of variation here, you see that it's also increasing over time. That is an indication there is greater heterogeneity in values of Gini coefficients across cities, right? There's greater dispersion. When we look at what's happening within the urban hierarchy, we actually see that larger cities have much higher levels of inequality and that they're growing at a much faster rate than in smaller cities. We can see this by mapping things out, right? I'm a geographer. We always have to look at maps. What we have here are our 85 cities, right? The larger the city, the larger the circle. The color coding scheme is as follows. The darker shaded areas are cities with higher levels of inequality. So you can see that city size relationship in this map, right? Five of Canada's six largest cities all have very high levels of inequality. The one exception is Ottawa, which is, of course, the nation's capital, home to lots of public sector employment, right? The other geographical divide, which is interesting to note, is if you scan the country or you sweep it east to west, look at what's happening in the west here, right? All cities in Alberta, in British Columbia, with the exception of Victoria, all have very high levels of inequality, right? And contrast this to eastern Canadian cities, which typically have much lower levels of inequality. When we actually rank the Gini coefficients and we look at the lowest 20 Gini coefficient values, 14 of those 20 Gini coefficients are actually in cities located in Quebec, right? So there's a really interesting divide that is emerging here. That was not necessarily the case 10, 15 years ago, okay? All right. Now, in terms of innovation, right, what we see here at the national level, a significant increase in the amount of patenting activity, so innovation increases by almost 40% over that 10-year time period. Again, it is largely concentrated in those larger, medium-large urban cities, and the growth is also much faster in those two areas, right? And there is more variation, so again, values diverge from one city to the next. Just to give you an idea of where the hotbeds of innovation are in Canada, this table lists the top 13 cities according to the number of patents granted in 2006, right? So the top city is Toronto, right? And the largest subcategory of patents, for those of you who are interested, right, are in machinery and computers. Ottawa is all about the telecommunications industry, or perhaps was, right? Vancouver, Montreal, right, strongly anchored in pharmaceutical and biotechnological industries, and the list goes down. Essentially, all of the larger cities are included in this top 13 list. What's interesting is if you think about the overall population these cities represent, right, we have about 52% of Canada's population in these 13 cities. In terms of patents, 82% of all Canadian inventions, right, registered with the USPTO happen in these 13 cities. So innovation is strongly concentrated in those centers. This graph shows the relationship between the level of inequality as measured by the Gini coefficient on the y-axis here and the level of innovation, right? We have our patent counts on the x-axis here, right? These two lines are references. These are the cross-city averages in terms of innovation and levels of inequality. And of course, the city size is indicated by the size of the circle. So the first thing you note is that if you were to plot a line through this graph or this scatter plot, you would see a strong positive relationship, right? Cities with higher levels of inequality are also associated with higher levels of innovation. Secondly, you also see the importance of that city size relationship, right? Most of the cities with high levels of innovation and high levels of inequality are in this northeastern quadrant, right? These are the larger cities, whereas the smaller cities tend to be in the southwestern part of the graph here, okay? So we see those two trends, though this is for only the year 2006. If I were to reproduce the graph over time, that positive relationship is actually increasing, right? Okay, now I know it's a Saturday morning. It's a little early for statistics, right? I'll try not to go into too much details, right? This is a bit more formal, right? So we've got that relationship, which seems to be positive, but we really want to try to tease it out, controlling for other factors, right? So what this model is doing is, just to give you a sense of what's happening here, right? On the left-hand side, you have the dependent variable. These are our measures of inequality, whether it's the Gini coefficient, right, for city I at time t, or the tile index. I'm interested in explaining the variation across cities and over time in levels of inequality, controlling for a series of variables, right? Of course, the key variable we're interested in is innovation. We also have city size controls, and then we have those economic variables, the socio-demographic characteristics, the institutional controls, right, that we mentioned earlier. Tau t here is a time fixed effects. This is essentially a variable saying that, okay, for 2001 and 2006, we have, you know, level changes in inequality across all cities in the country. And then we have an error term. This is the residual, what is left unexplained by the model, okay? And here are the results of that model. Now, there's a lot of information in this table. Let me walk you through it very gently, right? So we have two sets of models, one for the Gini coefficient as the dependent variable, one for the tile index, right? And for each, we start off with a very parsimonious model with only two variables, and then we're moving on to a more fully specified model where we include additional economic controls, and then at the very end here, everything is thrown into the kitchen sink, so to speak, right, with the socio-demographic characteristics and the institutional controls also included. So what are the results? Let's just focus on the Gini coefficient first here to simplify things. Look at the coefficient estimates for innovation. Regardless of what variables we actually include there, the coefficient estimate remains positive and is statistically significant. So in other words, right, cities with higher levels of innovation do have higher levels of inequality, right? The city size coefficient is also positive and significant up until the point we actually add the socio-demographic characteristics. Then we lose the significance on this characteristic, on this city size effect, right? Which is to be expected because we're controlling for all of the population characteristics in a given city. Now, in terms of the economic variables we defined earlier on, right, industry composition clearly matters. And in both the cases of manufacturing and government employment, we have negative and significant coefficients. So in other words, cities with higher levels of manufacturing activities will have lower levels of inequality, right? Manufacturing is an equalizer. So is public sector employment. In terms of the socio-demographic variables, right, not a lot of movement in terms of the female participation rate or the demographics. What is interesting is the impact on visible minority, which is positive and significant. So cities with higher levels of visible minorities are also associated with higher levels of inequality. That is something we see oftentimes in the US, right? So not very surprising in that sense. The institutional factors, not much traction there, right? None are significant across both models. And essentially the tile index, right, replicates what we see for the Gini coefficient. So it provides us with more robustness in that sense. In terms of the confidence in our results. Okay? So just to wrap things up, right, key findings, what are the geographical divides? Clearly, urban versus rural, large versus small cities. We also see differences from western to eastern parts of the country, right? But I think for the purposes of this particular conference, right, innovative cities are more unequal, right? And I've also been trying to use different measures of innovation. So looking at, for instance, knowledge-intensive business services as a proxy for innovation, right? The results hold. There's a positive and significant relationship there. And the other explanatory factors, we can't discard city size. Deindustrialization is clearly important. So is public sector employment. And there's little evidence in terms of unionization, minimum wage impacts, for instance. So what are the policy implications here, right? Clearly, I think what we need to be thinking of more closely is how inequality is actually evolving in cities, right? And in terms of the findings here, who are getting the benefits of the increase in innovative activities, right? So I think we have to be cautious about the amenities-based approach, right, which essentially promotes creativity and innovation as guiding principles for growth. We have to be thinking about the broader societal level redistribution mechanisms, something we have not been doing for some time, okay? Where's the research moving? We're actually extending this research in, I think, interesting new directions, and I just wanted to give you a bit of a flavor of what's happening here, right? So we're now looking at what is happening in terms of income dynamics inside Canada's largest cities. So what you have here is a map of Montreal neighborhoods, right? These are census tracts. There are 700 and some in 2006, standardized census tracts, that is. And what we're showing is median income. Now, the legend here is probably a little hard to read, but the red areas are neighborhoods with higher than average median income levels. These are the richer neighborhoods, right? And they're clustering together, in other words. So we have the West Island communities in and around Bidulphi. Here we have Westmount, Hampstead, right? L'Île des Sœurs. The blue areas are poorer neighborhoods or neighborhoods with below average median income levels. So if we do this exercise for 2006, we can also go back in time and replicate the map for 1991, for instance, right? Now, what's really interesting is when we look at the movement, right, the direction and the amplitude of movement over that time period across neighborhoods. What we get when we do that is this Rose diagram. Right, so this is something that geographers know well, right? You can imagine the Rose diagram having four quadrants. The northeastern quadrant here represents a direction of change whereby richer neighborhoods in 1991 are even more richer relative to other neighborhoods in 2006. So it's a positive co-movement, if you will. And at the other extreme, right, in the southwestern quadrant, you have poor neighborhoods becoming relatively poorer 15 years later. Now, this is for Montreal, and clearly what you see here is that there is spatial polarization or divergence, right, a pulling apart of the richer neighborhoods versus the poor neighborhoods. Now, this is for Montreal only. We actually see the same pattern happening for Toronto, Vancouver, in Calgary. It's not so much pronounced for places like Quebec and Winnipeg, but clearly there is something happening here, right? And we need to pay more attention to those kinds of patterns. Okay? So I'll stop there for this moment.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. We have about 8 minutes. Can I just maybe abuse my position here? As I was listening to it was extremely interesting. I was wondering if we were to try and study, let's say, creativity or cultural creativity, there's no equivalent of patents, there's no compulsory copyright registration, for example. I mean, are there measures like numbers of Arts Council grants or things like that? Could we imagine incorporating within it
forms of innovation that are not patent-based?
Yeah, I mean, there are different ways of actually approaching it. I think Richard actually talked about the challenges of defining creativity yesterday, which is a valid point. Patents are much more quantifiable, of course. You know, if you look at the literature, Richard Florida looks at occupations, right? We can think of specific cultural industries. But it is more challenging in that sense. In given the data that we have here, I think the probably the easiest approach would be to look at occupations, and we would have to target specific what are considered to be creative occupations, right? Now that's also open to debate in terms of how we actually go about defining that. But we could think of R&D spending. Yeah, there are various ways of actually trying to measure that.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
I can't believe I'm about to potentially defend Richard Florida here, who's taken quite a beating in the last couple of days. But you talked about this, your research showing the dark side of the Florida creativity thesis. Mm-hmm. My recollection is that he has data that shows that even non-creative people, skilled, semi-skilled people, do better in areas where there are high proportions of creative class people. And I don't think that's inconsistent with your data. Because, in other words, if you were counseling somebody, an unskilled person, where to go to seek wealth, it would still, I think, according to your data, make sense for that person to go to Calgary rather than to go to Alma, even if there's more equality in Alma. So I'm not sure that I understand how your data is showing the dark side if it's true that unskilled people are actually better off in areas where there are creative people.
Well, I think one way you can think about this is where the unskilled people actually start off from. What's the starting point, right? But then when you move into the city, for instance, the point that is being shown here is that the cleavage is growing, right, between those two types of high-skilled or low-skilled individuals. I mean, that's something we can't ignore. I mean, what strikes me as curious is that Florida does talk about this, that you can be better off by moving into a city where there is all kinds of innovative, creative action, if you will, right? But he's silent as to, you know, how these things actually play out, right? I mean, it's only recently, with all of the work, you know, the Canadian case is a bit exceptional. We've been behind the ball studying what's happening in terms of inequality patterns at the city level. In the U.S., there is literature which is actually very, you know, dynamic these days. What we see are similar patterns in terms of these city-level inequality level increasing in cities, in other words, right? But he's been talking a little bit about it, but he hasn't really addressed anything in his own work, right? So he's silent on that, and he's been criticized, I think, for neglecting that aspect to his work. Yeah.
Okay, we have probably time for two, maybe three questions. Richard?
Yeah, I'll play a sort of devil's advocate here. I think it's a great paper you presented, but there's two things that come to mind. First of all, could inequality be a spur to innovation?
Yeah.
So in other words, what is the causal sequence involved? Yeah. And second of all, could we be faced with a sort of a Kuznets situation where inequality is rising due to the innovation fast growth but will eventually fall? Because I know it's the fastest growing city, so I've done a little bit of work on inequality, and there's definitely a connection between rapidity of growth, both in incomes and in employment, and inequality.
Yeah.
So maybe when the growth slows down, things will sort themselves out. So I just want to hear you on those two possibilities.
Two good points, yeah. I mean, the first one on causality, you're absolutely right. Given it's a Saturday morning, I didn't want to show actual instrumental variable regression models, right? We're trying to get to causality, right?
We're all grateful.
I think so, right? So in the actual paper, I do have all kinds of robustness checks. And, you know, instrumental variable regressions, so there's an endogeneity problem, right? I mean, innovation can go both ways in terms of its relationship to inequality. So how do you know it's actually innovation leading to inequality and not the other way around, right? So this is one way of getting at it. And what we've done is use instruments. I mean, the key is how do you figure out what instruments to use, which are not, you know, correlated with the endogenous variable, but yet uncorrelated with the residual. What we've done is actually come up with a neat way of looking at the spatial lag variable. So instead of observing innovation in one city, what we're doing is
taking the average values of innovation of neighboring cities, right? So that's one way of doing it. And we also have a spatially temporal lag of innovation. So we can do that. And the answer is innovation leads to inequality. That's the direction of causality. So I think that's an important point because we haven't really been able to show that yet. The Kuznets argument is interesting. Yeah, I mean, I've got another paper where we're actually trying to tease this out. You saw I had an economic development variable there. In the other paper, we actually have a polynomial where we try to see how the direction of change is in the first instance and whether there is a curve, you know, that inverse U shape. We actually do find evidence of it, which is an interesting point. But I've got to work on that a little bit more. Yeah, but you're absolutely right. That is something to take into consideration here.
Okay, one more.
Sorry, just quick. Can you say a few words about the source of that inequality? Is it just a rise at the top due to innovators cashing in, or is there a decline at the bottom?
Yeah, I mean, there are multiple things happening. So clearly, I mean, we're being pulled up from the top, right? I mean, you know, Calgary has the dubious honor of being the most unequal city in terms of earnings distribution in Canada. In Calgary, back in 1991, you know, the top 1% of the income distribution had maybe 6 or 7% of the overall income in the city. Fast forward to 2006, it's almost 19%, right? So something has changed. This is clearly, you know, something is being pulled at the top. You know, there are gains at various points in the distribution, but it really is strongly concentrated at the top. I think that's an interesting point to make, yeah.
I just have two very brief questions. One is, you consider a period where the Gini coefficient was indeed increasing, but why do you not consider a larger period of time? Because there's kind of an inverted U-shape over the 20th century.
Limited by data availability.
But then it seems like it's like you're looking at the weather of the day and you're concluding that there's climate change. But, I mean, you know, if you need to consider the Gini coefficient over a period of time that's not strictly growing in order to prove a correlation, I find.
Well, I mean, at the city level, we just don't have that data yet, right? I mean, but if you look at national level patterns, you know, the 1970s and 1980s were a situation where, you know, Canada was relatively flat, right? I mean, Lars Orsberg talks about, you know, studying inequality in Canada during those years was like watching grass grow, right? There was nothing happening. It was boring, right? Then all of a sudden, in the 1990s, something happens, something changes, and then we go from there. So what I've presented here is essentially, I am constrained by data availability.
I just have a second quick question. Do you look at patent, obviously, which is the
yes.
you know, most used measure in economics? Did you consider that the fact that the behavior of innovators towards patents has changed over the period that you're considering, like the 50 years, in that we're depositing a lot more patents today than we were, you know, 50 years ago for probably the same quantity of innovation?
Yeah.
And how do you measure for that?
It's a good point. You know, I think it's artificially constructed into the data set. There's not much we can do here. You know, we might come up with some sort of an adjustment factor, but I'm not aware of national level studies that here in Canada have tried to look at that. And if so, perhaps we could, you know, apply some sort of a correction to it. But I think, you know, even in the U.S. where there have been these kinds of simulations, right, I mean, the trend is clearly one towards greater and greater levels of innovative activity in that sense. And I mean, the counter argument would
can
be...
Can I just get one more?
So
well,
if you,
we're really, really over time, I'm sorry.
No, that's true.
Okay. Thank you, Sebastian, for a very good